The Capital Investment Committee hearing for February 1st is called to order. Representative Hanson, can I have a motion to approve the minutes for January 30th?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move the minutes for January 30th.
Representative Hanson, move approval of the minutes for January 30th. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevailed and the minutes for January 30th are approved. Members, today we'll be having budget recommendations for five different state agencies. So the first up is Department of Human Services. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dave Greenman. I'm the Chief Financial Officer with the Department of Human Services. And I have with me Jennifer Sommerfeld, who's the Legislative Director for the Children and Family Services Administration, and Marshall Smith, who's the Chief Executive Officer with Direct Care and Treatment. Thank you for having me today. The governor's capital investment request for the Department of Human Services includes nine proposals, which you see in front of you in priority order. They include a package of requests for direct care and treatment, which is the department's specialized behavioral health care system serving about 12,000 people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, substance use disorder, and co-occurring conditions. We provide those services in about 200 facilities statewide, measuring over 3 million square feet. They range from group homes to psychiatric hospitals and large inpatient programs, and we provide them those services 24/7, and they must be provided in a safe and therapeutic treatment environment. DCT facilities are highly regulated and must be kept in sound repair in order to comply with state and federal regulations for patient care. Many facilities are aging and in need of urgent structural repairs. Some structures are over 100 years old. The package also includes funding for grant programs to construct and rehab facilities for the delivery of human services delivered by other governmental entities and nonprofit organizations and tribal governments. The programs that we're seeking funding for for these type of facilities are where there's a lack of proper infrastructure for those facilities. So to start with, I will turn it over to Jennifer Sommerfeld to talk about the first set of proposals we've got.
Director Sommerfeld, please identify yourself for proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jennifer Sommerfeld, I'm the Legislative Director for Children and Family Services at DHS. And our first proposal that I'm going to talk about relates to funding for early childhood facilities. The governor's capital budget includes $12.4 million in funding for early childhood facilities. Half of the funds are general obligation bonds, and half of the funds are general fund appropriation. The grants would be available to state agencies, political subdivisions, and tribes, and they'd be used to renovate or construct early childhood facilities. The funding is intended to help address significant needs statewide, and I'll just note that recent surveys have identified hundreds of millions of dollars of requests from school superintendents and early childhood facilities. So there is a need for these funds statewide. Next. The next proposal improves and expands emergency shelter options statewide by providing grants to state agencies, political subdivisions, tribal nations, and private nonprofit entities to acquire, pre-design, design, or construct, furnish and equip facilities for emergency homeless shelters for individuals and their families. The entire $86 million in this package would come from the general fund and would be used for those purposes.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Marshall Smith. I'm the health system CEO for Direct Care and Treatment. I'm going to provide you with the remainder of DCT priorities. The first one is for the Sunrise and Tomlinson building renovation. This is a $21.56 million request provided for phase two of a multi-phased project to remodel, construct, furnish, and equip existing buildings on the lower campus at St. Peter. Phase two will create additional space for our community preparation services and make it possible for MSOP to comply with the court's orders to treat clients in a less restrictive environment. A rationale for this request is that MSOP clients in the later stages of treatment may petition the court to transfer to community preparation services. For CPS clients, MSOP operates a residential facility on the grounds of the St. Peter campus located outside of the secured perimeter. As a background to that, the courts are granting transfer orders for clients to move to CPS as an increased rate. At an increased rate, an MSOP needs to increase its CPS beds and programming to comply with these orders. There continues to be a wait list of 18 clients with court orders to transfer and to activate, and two of them are activating litigation cases towards us. However, CPS is at full capacity right now. This request will help us avoid contempt to court issues, and this is the ninth year that we've made this request for funding. In our funding, there has been a previous appropriation in 2014 and 2020, and we do have a deferred maintenance of $13.5 million. That's part of the project request. And the other budget impacts is that there's additional funding for FTEs and other operating expenses that will be requested upon completion of this project. The second request is AMRTC building upgrades. This request is to design and remodel the Miller Building, which will provide additional treatment space for patients who have both substance use disorders and co-occurring mental health conditions. DHS's chemical dependency treatment program currently operates in an aging facility with double occupancy, which undermines effective treatment. This setting can lead to increased patient aggression towards staff and fellow patients. Funding of $16.3 million would design, renovate, furnish, and equip the north and south wings of the Miller Building at the Anoka Regional Treatment Center. This will be phase one of a two-phased project. Our rationale: currently the north wing is vacant and the entire interior has been cleared for asbestos and demolished. This project will remodel the space for chemical dependency residential treatment, currently located in the south wing. When the remodeling is complete, the chemical dependency residential treatment unit will move to the north wing after the south wing is vacant. Additional work to replace the HVAC system was funded in 2018. That will also be completed at this time. This project includes HVAC, plumbing, electrical, security, life safety systems, roof replacement, windows, doors, reconfiguring and remodeling space. It'll design and abate asbestos and any other hazardous material that is found and address building code deficiencies. By moving these patients to a renovated north wing of the Miller Building, the program will be able to operate and maintain operations and move to a more therapeutic environment. As far as deferred maintenance, the building was constructed in 1951 and is very good, sound structural condition. However, a deferred maintenance is estimated at $8.4 million. There were two other appropriations for AMRTC in 2017 for ligature appropriation. that's reducing any type of danger for patients and clients, and security upgrades along with roof and HVAC replacement. We will be asking for additional funds as part of the budget impact. We'll be asking for additional funds that will be requested for staff and other support costs depending upon the type of programming that goes into this new space. The third priority we have is the St. Peter Water and Sewer upgrades. This is a request for $12.4 million to upgrade and replace the water, sanitary, and storm sewer infrastructure on the St. Peter campus. This will ensure that the state-owned facilities used for direct care and treatment are functional, safe, and in good repair. Our rationale for this request is that the current drinking water system and sanitary and storm sewer systems on the lower campus were constructed in the early 1950s and has far exceeded their useful lives. In 2018, DCT contracted with an engineer firm to conduct a water and sewer system analysis, and the analysis found several deficiencies and recommended replacement of the water main, sanitary sewer, and storm sewer infrastructure located throughout the entire campus. Without improvement, the probability of system failure is high. It is imperative to replace this critical infrastructure to ensure that the campus can continue to operate a 24/7, 365 day per year and serve the needs of 1,100 people, consisting of patients, clients, and staff. We previously asked for no appropriation, and there is a deferred maintenance estimated at $12.4 million. The other priorities I'm going to just cover briefly include energy upgrades. This is a request for $11.1 million from the general fund to install renewable energy systems and energy upgrades for buildings on the campus in St. Peter, Moose Lake, and Anoka. The proposal aligns with the governor's strategic priorities for climate change and will reduce the overall cost of the future operating budget for the campus and eliminate the peak demand premium that is charged or incurred because of 24/7 operations. This project is fully funded. If fully funded, we'll have a payback period of less than 10 years throughout through the energy savings. Asset preservation. The request is for $8.8 million in funding with a $2.1 million in general obligation bonds and $6.7 million from the general fund. Funding will be used for urgently needed repairs at state-owned residential and treatment facilities to ensure they are functional, safe, and in good repair. The proposed work includes everything from roofs, windows, doors, exterior walls, to HVAC, electrical, plumbing, upgrades, and tuck points, and paving around the facility. The next one is demolition of Johnson Hall. This request removes a vacant building that is in poor condition and presents a health and safety hazard on the St. Peter campus. The building has been closed for nearly 5 years. It has a negative appraised value of $200,000. Demolition would negate more than $5.6 million in deferred maintenance. And the last priority that we have is security system upgrades. DCT's security system needs regular replacement and upgrades. $6.4 million from the state's general fund will help replace the security perimeter fence at the Minnesota Sex Offender Program in Moose Lake and replace thousands of outdated interior and exterior security cameras at all DCT facilities to enhance the safety and security of our staff, patients, and clients. Cameras typically have 3 to 7 years of life expectancy, depending on whether they're used interior or exterior. There's no current mechanism to upgrade these systems without dramatically impacting the facility's operating budgets. These systems are key to safe operations for patients, clients, and staff. Thank you.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to ask a question here, not necessarily something that I'm in agreement with, but these things come to me, I just want your response. Are some of these proposals, particularly maybe Sunrise and Tomlinson, less restrictive for the residents there and thereby could cause potential danger to the public at large?
Mr. Greenman.
Mr. Chair, I'll defer to Chief Executive Officer Smith.
Yeah, let me look at the question. Is what happens if we don't get the funding for this project? Is clients may move to community preparation services only after the court determines if it's appropriate for them to continue in a less restrictive environment.
Let me start over again. A little music in the background.
So clients may move to community preparation services only after the courts determine if it's appropriate for them to move to a less restrictive environment. The bonding proposal allows us to add 30 more beds to the existing Green Acres and Sunrise buildings and renovate and upgrade the Tomlinson building. Without the funding to increase capacity to CPS, MSOP may not be able to transfer all these clients with a court order into the program. These transfer delays increase the risk of litigation of clients, including motions for contempt before the commitment appeal panel. In current and previous lawsuits, clients have actually asked the court to jail the commissioner and levy fines as part of the motions for contempt.
Do you agree with that?
Representative
Erdahl. I was just kind of joking. Do you agree that they should jail the commissioner?
Commissioner Smith.
Mr. Chair, we're not in agreement.
Chair and Representative, we're not in agreement.
Oh, okay.
The prospect of a lengthy wait for transfer to CPS after receiving court approval discourages clients from participating in treatment because they believe their progress and possible provisional or full discharge from the program may be delayed due to factors beyond their control. And this is both counterproductive and countertherapeutic. To clients who've worked very hard to progress through treatment. If they don't get this additional beds, then clients will remain in the secured treatment area when they should actually be transferred out.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and Commissioner. What I'm doing is, you know, people have questions, and I'm just passing it on here. I want you to give assurance that the public safety is not endangered with this.
Commissioner Smith, or
Mr. Chair, Representative, the department and direct current treatment take public safety very seriously. These individuals will continue to be on the campus. They continue to be supervised on the campus. The purpose of this program is to provide them with somewhat more freedom within the campus as they progress through treatment. And part of that is, frankly, to ensure that they're getting the right treatment as they progress along, but also to comply with, as CEO Smith mentioned, with a court order that's telling us that we need to provide these progressive services as they advance through treatment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Smith, just going back to the St. Peter water and sewer upgrades, there was a bullet point saying that the project was submitted for ARP funding. What is the status of that application? It's on page 10.
St. Peter water and sewer.
Could you repeat the question, Chair?
So the third bullet point right there said that the project was submitted for ARP funding. What is the status of that application?
I would have to look that up and return that information back to you, Chair.
Thank you.
I don't have that readily available.
And then, Director Summerfield, can you confirm for the emergency shelter facilities, is that proposed in the governor's capital budget, or is that proposed in the DHS operating budget?
This is proposed in the capital. This is proposed in the capital budget.
Okay, thank you. Members, any additional questions for DHS? Seeing none, thank you all for coming by before the committee.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda, we have the Department of Public Safety. Welcome, Commissioner Jacobson. Please identify yourself and proceed. Please proceed, Commissioner.
Good afternoon, everyone. Chair Lee, Vice Chair Ryer, Lead Erdahl, and members of the committee, thank you for having the Department of Public Safety here today to discuss our bonding projects. With me is our Legislative Director, Jordan Halt-Tofterdahl, and he'll be helping me through the slides as I go through the presentation and can help answer questions as need be. Just a quick overview of our capital budget requests. On the slide, you're going to see that we're requesting several public safety projects that really will be needed to allow us to continue to best serve the state of Minnesota. Number one, we need additional funding for the State Emergency Operations Center. Without this funding, we really cannot break ground to begin the building process. We need more space for the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension for a whole number of reasons, but we would like to build a Southern Minnesota Regional Lab. We would also like to finish out some space in the basement area of the current DCA location on Maryland Avenue. We're also, of course, responsible for administrating other grants to local units of government, and we have several projects that we need funding for. And the next slide. For Homeland Security, we needed, again, additional funding for the State Emergency Operations Center. As you may know, that in 2020, the legislature approved $29 million for a new State Emergency Operations Center. We started work on the project, but unfortunately, as we completed planning and started moving to finalizing the design, costs certainly have risen since that time. So we do need additional funding for that State Emergency Operations Center. That would, on the next slide, would be increased costs are $11.392 million to break ground on this project. We have internally with our staff taken steps to reduce costs while still maintaining a building that we think will provide our state with a modern, reliable state emergency operations center. To build the original design that we first brought to you in 2020 would cost over $50 million today, and our request to you today would be more than double. The State Emergency Operations Center, as you know, is needed to help Minnesota on some of its worst days. And the facility we have now is just not enough to serve the state of Minnesota as well as we would like to see. The BCA, the Southern Lab that we would like to build, again, we're currently out of space at our other two locations. As you are well aware, this is a time when the amount of work through the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is definitely on the increase. The amount of lab, especially work, is increasing. Our evidence submissions for DNA analysis have increased by 120% since 2009 through that analysis, which, as you know, is critical. Controlled substance submissions have nearly doubled over the last 5 years, and digital media evidence is growing immensely, with that analysis having increased 122% just since between 2017 and 2021. So to create more capacity for the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension to be able to best serve all of our state of Minnesota, we're looking to build that Southern Regional Lab and office. The pre-design work for this was completed in 2020, or was funded in 2020 and completed in June of 2021. We are requesting $47.6 million to build. This includes planning for current and future needs to meet the demands for service, which again continue to go up. It would include that really valuable laboratory space, investigators and training space for local law enforcement to help us continue to serve the state of Minnesota. The BCA did look at renting or remodeling other spaces, but with all the laboratory requirements and given the unique needs of that building, the most cost-effective process at this time would be building new. As you know, we also have our main laboratory and BCA building on Maryland Avenue, and as with the last project, the BCA certainly needs some more space to do that critical work required of them. The BCA headquarters was, as it is now, was completed in 2003. It is now 20 years old. It's still a great building and in great shape. And with some improvement, we can expand the number, capacity, and update security to the needed levels that are really required to continue on. We're also requesting $6.03 million to make those needed improvements at the Maryland Avenue facility. We have unfinished space in the basement that was intended for a gun range, but it was never built. With that space, we can turn it into meeting space, workstations, and create about 44 more workstations that we need for our staff. This will also include a perimeter fence on three sides of the building for added security for our employees and visitors. About 15% of our employees at the BCA are sworn staff, the rest are civilian staff, and so that fence does serve for protection not only for our paid staff sworn, but also the 85% that are non-sworn staff, and also the public as they come and visit and do work out of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And lastly, again, we're asking for funding for the administration of those grants. Part of the request is $143,000. We do have 8 local projects recommended by the governor. Those grants are over $38 million for those 8 projects. They include fire stations, police stations, local emergency operations centers, and training centers. With that, that's a general overview, and we'll stand for any questions you may have.
Commissioner, can I ask you to identify yourself for the record, please, before questions?
My oversight, Bob Jacobson, Commissioner of Public Safety.
Thank you. Representative Grasso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, thank you for coming here and talking to us today. And I'm listening to your presentation, and I'm wondering what kind of backlog do you guys have on your evidence processing?
Commissioner.
What kind of background Backlog. Oh, backlog on processing. I know our goal is to be able to process within 30 days, but our current backlog in many cases is I believe, around 6 months.
6 months.
Representative Grasso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, does that put some of these cases in danger of timing out to where they're not going to get prosecuted, or?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair. Representative. You know, our key approach is to make sure and serve the citizens and be able to protect crime victims around the state of Minnesota, prosecute as need be, and make sure that those who may be innocent are also identified through those processes. And I think it's imperative that timely processing and getting those cases done on a timely basis really does serve to help protect our citizens. I think we've worked with local prosecutors to make sure if there's evidence that is still in process to be analyzed, they're aware of that. But certainly, I think quicker timing in getting evidence back serves not only our victims, but also those who may be accused of criminal offenses.
Representative Grasso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've just caught the mention of the digital evidence, how much that has increased, 122%. Could you just give us just a kind of a little breakdown of what that digital, what type of stuff that digital evidence is?
Sure. I think,
Commissioner.
Evidence analysis, the digital.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Lee. I know as we're gathering digital evidence, it's increasing immensely, the number of computers and devices that we are taking into evidence. And a lot of that, I know, has to do with investigation of pornography, child pornography cases that are going on in the state of Minnesota. And we're finding that there's volumes and volumes of devices that we need to take in and analyze. I think that's a significant part of the evidence that we're taking in.
And Senator Grasso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's gone up 122% between 17 and 21.
That's correct, Representative.
That's a big jump. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, Representative Gross will ask my question, but I just want to clarify the Maryland building is the only site in Minnesota that handles these types of things?
Commissioner.
The Maryland site is the primary site for handling that evidence. I'm not sure if our other facility in Rochester may be handling some of that, but it is primarily, that is where most of our forensics will take place, yes.
Representative Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What percentage of the work currently done at the Maryland site would be transferred to Mankato?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair. Representative, I'm not sure that I could answer that question at this point. We could certainly get back to you, or we get an estimate from our representatives in the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension.
Representative Dahl.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. So your goal is 30 days, now it can be closer to 6 months. So with the Mankato facility, do you think you'd be getting back into the 30-day range again?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Representative, absolutely. That is the ultimate goal, is to have that 30-day turnaround time in our forensic evidence. We believe that with the additional laboratory space and the additional staffing that we should be able to accomplish that.
Representative Dahl.
Thank you.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. Commissioner, thank you for being here. I think you might have just answered this, but I just wanted to clarify your southern regional facility. Where is that located? It's not mentioned in your materials.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair. Representative, that would be in the city of Mankato.
Okay. All right. And
Representative Carroll.
Thank you. And so that covers the entire southern region?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair. Representative. Yes, sir. As we looked at where to put that laboratory, Mankato was seen as the most central location in the southern part of the state of Minnesota that best accessible for our law enforcement partners around the state of Minnesota, especially southern Minnesota.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair Lee, and to our commissioner. Just bouncing off some of the questions that have been asked so far, of course, we know in Minnesota we have the crisis with missing, murdered Indigenous, but also with African heritage women, girls, and LGBTQ folks. Could you speak to what providing the investigative and the laboratory services in southern Minnesota, what kind of that impact would look like specifically for ending gender-based violence? We know so often that in the investigative side is how come our relatives don't come home and we don't have justice and healing. And so curious if you could illuminate what kind of impact this would have on preventing and ending that violence.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair, Representative. And again, you know, bottom line for us at the BCA and the Department of Public Safety is safety of everyone. Certainly as we can increase the laboratory turnaround time and increase our forensic services, the quicker we can get that turned around, the better. Certainly, people of color have been victimized, and we prioritize violent crimes through this. So if there's a violent crime, such as assault, murder, or rape, we prioritize those to get those done as quickly as we possibly can. So certainly a turnaround time is going to help all Minnesotans, including indigenous, African-American communities, persons of color, and quite frankly, all Minnesotans.
So you know, further questions. Thank you, Commissioner, for coming by before us today.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda, we have the Pollution Control Agency. Welcome, Commissioner Kadelka and Director Johnson. As you come up, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. One second while we pull up our presentation here, but for the record, my name is Tom Johnson. I'm the Government Relations Director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and with me today is Kirk Kadelka, our Assistant Commissioner at the MPCA for Land and Strategic Initiatives. Thank you for the opportunity today to walk through the Pollution Control Agency's capital bonding proposals. It's important to note, first of all, that all of our budget and bonding proposals are rooted in our core mission, which is to protect and improve Minnesota's environment and human health. Whether it's supporting communities as they adapt to a warmer and wetter climate, investing in technology to monitor nutrients, or expanding infrastructure and, for recycling and composting to meet our state waste goals, it's always in service to that core mission. On the next slide here, we see an overview, an overall picture of the MPCA's requests. As you can see, there's a mix of general obligation bonds and general fund dollars. I would also quickly note that this package of proposals is close to exactly the same as the proposals from last year that came from the MPCA, with some changes to account for inflationary costs, mostly in the capital assistance projects that Commissioner Kadelka will be covering. Our first proposal to highlight here is the Local Government Stormwater Construction Grant Program. This proposal directly builds on MPCA's previous planning grants to local units of government for assessing risks to their stormwater infrastructure from climate change and to develop and prioritize plans for actions to increase resilience. That grant program, which was recommended by the governor in 2021 and authorized with a $2 million appropriation from the legislature last biennium, that grew out of conversations with and surveys of local leaders who indicated that funding for implementation of adaptation practices to reduce flooding and impacts of extreme weather is a barrier. The MPCA conducted a statewide high-level survey in 2019 about stormwater infrastructure needs, and 69% of respondents wanted to add more stormwater storage to their systems. Half the survey responses were outside the seven-county metro, just as a reference point. This bonding proposal is complementary to the grant and loan programs that the Public Facilities Authority administers. So we worked with PFA to develop this proposal because over the long term we recognize this is something that PFA may lead in the long term, but not currently this would be appropriate to start at the MPCA. This proposal would also position the state favorably to receive and administer additional federal dollars to support stormwater infrastructure and climate resilience when that becomes available. Next slide, please. This next proposal is for the infrastructure associated with a continuous real-time nitrogen monitoring network in the Mississippi, Minnesota, Red River, and St. Louis River basins. 25% of Minnesota's population gets their drinking water from these major river systems, and millions of people drink surface water that originates in the state. Obviously, the Great Lakes states, Canadian provinces to the north, the Mississippi River to the south. Specifically, 18 million people get their drinking water from the Mississippi River downstream of Minnesota. Too much nitrate in drinking water presents a drinking water risk. Most water treatment plants are not designed to remove nitrate, and elevated nitrate presents an added cost for upgrades and treatment. This monitoring network will collect continuous real-time water quality data to track progress towards state and national goals, including the reducing and designing to shrink the Gulf of Mexico hypoxic dead zone. Just want to note that the infrastructure for this continuous nitrate monitoring would be similar and integrated into the current DNR, Department of Natural Resources, long-term assets that monitor river level and flow. So similar to those assets, the monitors in the stream would be linked to enclosed housings on the right-of-way containing recording and transmission equipment. And that wireless equipment would transmit the data back to the MPCA. At this point, I will turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Kadelka to cover the next items.
Commissioner, please identify yourself for proceeding.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Kirk Kadelka. I'm an Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and work on land issues. Our first one is something you've seen before. We've come before the legislature seeking funds to address legacy contamination. And the site we want to talk to you today about is in Andover, and it's the Red Oaks neighborhood. In 2021, we were doing sampling and found 1,4-dioxin and PFAS in the neighborhood. And as a result, we've identified 53 different homes that have exceedances of the health-based values set by the Department of Health. We have put these homes on bottled water, but a long-term solution is needed. The best solution moving forward while working with the city is connecting them to the municipal drinking water system. So the proposal is to do that. A portion of the funding of the $6.1 million is in general obligation bonds, which would be used for the main water connections, and then private connections to the homes would have to be from general fund to ensure that these residents that are exceeding the health-based values would be provided safe drinking water into the future. The next category of projects is the Capital Assistance Program. This is dealing with solid waste infrastructure across the state. Just at a high level, the state and MPCA sets high-level policy for solid waste and permitting and carries out the permitting. But the day-to-day operations and implementation of waste prevention, recycling, composting programs are done by counties and local units of government. In order to aid that effort, the state created what is called the Capital Assistance Program, or CAP. This allows for local units of government to receive state funding to help meet the state goals in terms of recycling and composting. We have a number of projects here, and I just want to go through them very quickly here. The first is working with organics. We know already about 20% of what is thrown away is food waste. In addition, there are other things that can be composted, such as soil paper products and cardboard and the like. We believe this is a large waste stream that if we want to reach our recycling goals in the metro area of 75% and elsewhere across the state, we need to remove this from the waste stream from landfills and waste energy facilities and handle them in a way that adds value to it, creating compost and other materials that have benefit added. So this would create a $12 million grant project for the MPCA to help facilities across Minnesota to develop it when they are ready. These next two projects I'm going to talk about are ones that were funded in 2020 from the legislature. And the first is the Pope Douglas Solid Waste Project. Pope Douglas is a consortium of a number of counties that are working together to create an integrated solid waste program. The first phase was to move a number of buildings, including enhancing their household hazardous waste facility, which was funded by the legislature. The second phase is updates to their MRF, also known as a materials recovery facility. This will remove recyclable materials from the waste stream before the materials go to the waste energy facility to recover energy, and this will increase the recycling rate as a result. As I mentioned before, phase one was put forward in 2020, and as a result of the phasing in that, the project costs have gone up because of multiple years of inflation being built in. The next project is a partnership between Scott and Dakota counties. They have a household hazardous waste facility they would like to build along the border of the two counties to meet increased demand. Dakota County currently has a facility that is over capacity, and this would allow for access to household hazardous waste material collection in an area that is high growth. This would be, because of the phase one funding, a site has been identified in Lakeville for it to be located, and the funding here that we're asking for, the $8 million, would be to actually build the facility. Household hazardous waste are things such as paint thinners, paint, batteries, and that don't work well in the normal waste stream, and this helps our solid waste industry by keeping it out of those areas. The next is Olmsted County. They also would like to build a materials recovery facility, a MRF, to handle the materials that Dodge County and Olmsted County sent to the waste energy facility. It would remove plastics and other recyclable materials before it goes to the waste energy facility and increase the recycling rate as a result and make the waste energy facility more effective. Next project is Polk County. This is something that the legislature has helped fund in the past. However, because of hardships with staffing in that, they are looking to upgrade to robotics, be more efficient and effective in removing recyclable materials from the waste stream before it goes to the waste energy facility. Polk County works with a system of counties in the northwest part of Minnesota, and so this would benefit multiple counties. The next is Chicago County. This is looking to expand their household hazardous waste facility that would serve not only Chicago County, but Isanti and Washington County. This is an area of high growth and also already a place that is over capacity. And finally is Cass County. Cass County actually has a 30-year-old facility there that handles household hazardous waste, but also a recycling hub for a number of locations, including working with Leech Lake Tribal Nation. This is actually a project that was funded by CAP originally and now has outlived its lifespan, and they're looking to upgrade the facility due to unmet needs. Thank you, Chair and committee members, for your time. We're available for questions.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Kadelka and Mr. Johnson. You know, I want to go back to the nitrate sensors, and you know, I'm just kind of wondering after tens of millions of dollars spent in clean water funds and other funds on nitrate monitoring. You know, we just keep monitoring, and we admire the problem getting worse. And meanwhile, we have air quality. You know, I think we were successful in the budget a couple years ago about getting at least some air quality monitoring. And those machines could be also general fund. You know, if we're not going to take action on nitrates, except monitor, maybe we should look at monitoring air quality where we don't have the data. And try to see if there's something we could do there.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hanson. The agency is not opposed at all to air monitoring. Certainly, I think we put forward some air monitoring assistance to some updates to our air quality monitoring. And we also have put forward in the governor's budget a large data package that would make sure that we're have the staff necessary to comb through a lot of this data, which really is the barrier to expanding our monitoring networks. So that for air quality in particular, because there's so much data that comes in from air quality monitoring. So I think that would be one item I would say. And then we also there's an item in the governor's budget related to modernization, and a lot of that would be investing in our systems to modernize and automate and really capture that data more effectively as well. So I think we're on the same page with you, Representative, on expanding those networks as well.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on a different subject, you know, we have members that are concerned about the freeway landfill, and over the last 4 years we've had kind of start again, stop again discussions about entering into that. Just maybe like some impressions about any desire or discussion on bonding request for the freeway landfill, and then also to the north, the Western Lake Superior Sanitary System and PFAS. I know there's been some requests about large remediation and storage there. So those two large projects, the freeway landfill, and any impressions on that, and then the PFAS problem up in Western Lake Superior Sanitary District.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hanson. I'll defer to Assistant Commissioner Kadelka on the freeway landfill, but I will say that as it relates to infrastructure and PFAS, there is an item in the governor's budget, $25 million, particularly for drinking water protection. I know that doesn't relate specifically to WLLSD up on the North Shore, but there certainly we are looking to invest in infrastructure as it relates specifically to PFAS, and make sure that when there are future federal new maximum contaminant levels or other values that come from the federal government, that we're prepared to address those as they come. Thank you for that, and then I'll pass to
Commissioner.
Chair and committee members, just to add on to the PFAS, the governor's budget also includes $4 million in grants for PFAS source reduction, so that entities that are working with us on our PFAS monitoring plan, like Westlake Superior Sanitary District, as they find it in their intake, these would be grants made available to reduce PFAS coming into those facilities and for us to reduce the amount of PFAS going into the environment overall. Specifically in regards to freeway landfill, I want to thank the legislature for about 2 years ago helping update the legislation regarding priority qualified facilities, which freeway landfill is a facility. And the issue there is the closed landfill program is based on the idea that there are voluntary parties that come into and want the state to take over the long-term care and the perpetuity of these sites. In the case of freeway, that is not the case. So the legislature created through the qualified priority facilities another avenue to move forward. And we're moving forward on that avenue right now. The big issue right now is access. We're done with 100% design of the remedial actions that could be done there, whether a dig and haul and dig and line. We've done additional investigation at the site to understand the groundwater contamination and also the location of the waste on the western boundary, and also done some soil vapor work to determine properties or buildings on the property are protected. The big issue is access, and because of the change in the law through the legislature, we're working through those processes, but that's going to take a little while. We need to ensure access so that when we go out to bid for the projects on those two designs and come forward with a cost to the legislature to seek funding, we are able to move forward soon after that funding is allocated. A contractor is not going to continue to hold on and wait for us to get access to the property once they have the funding in hand and the contract in hand. We want to make sure they're able to move forward as fast as possible.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it was 3 years ago we visited the site as a capital investment committee, and you know, and then I think we've passed legislation year after year. So just to be clear, the administration does not have any budget proposal for freeway landfill at this moment.
Mr. Johnson or Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and committee members, correct. At this moment, we do not have a request.
So, Mr. Johnson, just going back to page 3 real quickly, I know that you and the commissioner have mentioned a few programs. So all the general fund items that's included on page 3 is proposed through the capital budgets, and then some of the items that you mentioned that are not here will be through the operating budget. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is correct. The items that are general fund in this overview page are meant to come through the capital investment, and we had worked with MMB on what would be appropriate to be general obligation bonds and what would be appropriate to be cash. So,
and then on page 4 for the local government stormwater construction grants, you said that the $25 million requests could achieve around 12 projects. Have the agency identified these 12 projects, or is that just based off of information that you have that you might be able to achieve 12 different projects?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. We have not identified all the projects yet. I think that would be examples that we have a few examples, such as modernization of Duluth's stormwater infrastructure. We heard this as a need to increase storage and size of pipes to handle more and increased rainfall events. So those are examples of the types of projects. We would imagine that about 12 projects would fit the bill, but we have not identified all of those yet.
And then moving on to page 6, the legacy contaminants for the Recto neighborhood in Andover. Understanding that, you know, this deals with PFAS contamination, and from the federal IIJA, there's specific funding for emerging contaminants. Would this project qualify for that funding stream?
Mr. Chair and committee members, the bulk of the homes, just a few handful, are for PFAS. The rest are for 1,4-dioxane. So we have 53 homes in the area, and about 45 of them are from 1,4-dioxane and not PFAS. We would need to talk some more to PFA to see if it's eligible, but 1,4-dioxane has been a contaminant that we have not talked about and using those funds for because of other needs and emerging contaminants.
I have a question.
Sorry, this is only for members of the committee. So can you touch base? I know that Mr. Freeman is here. I don't know if Mr. Freeman has any comments for this right now, but I would like to know, does this project qualify for that? And if it does, why are we calling out a specific project for this when there are other communities out there? You know, Chair Hansen mentioned WSSD, you know, previously, you know, Bemidji, that they have to submit their requests. And just trying to get a better understanding of this particular submission. And then regarding the capital assistance program, I think I have communicated with the agency on this. You know, my interest in this is that I don't want any of these way sites to be located near vulnerable communities, especially indigenous communities, communities of color, or people from underserved communities. And I asked specifically, have the counties that are in the proposal or the MPCA have done any community engagement and outreach to see if these facilities should be located where they are, or what is the impact to the communities? And so I wanted to know, have the MPCA done any engagement with the surrounding communities around this project?
Mr. Chair and committee members, if it's okay, I go back to the emerging contaminant piece a little bit. These projects are different than the usual type of projects that go through PFA for a few reasons. One, these are contaminated sites that fall under our Superfund programs, and these are what we see as fund finance. These are ones, because there is no responsible party identified at this time, the state comes in and does the work 100%. It's not a situation where the city then has a match or as part of their regular growth process that does go through the PFA process. So these are different in that regard and have been handled separately. In regards to the question on the outreach in that, we work with our local partners, the project proposers, and they have done outreach to their communities. We can supply that information to the committee on those efforts.
Thank you. Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the individuals that had the question, their question, Mr. Chair and members, is so they live in that Red Oaks neighborhood, and they're kind of wondering when the situation will be fixed, when the legislature will come in with some bonding dollars. And the one lady, the accepted health level is over 200 times.
So 2,000 times.
Yeah, by the way, remember. Yeah.
Commissioner, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the agency does not have funding to move forward with this without it being appropriated by the legislature. This was part of the governor's proposal for the bonding bill last year, and we are again working with the local legislators and the city for funding this year to be able to move forward.
Representative Franson.
Mr. Chair, do you anticipate there being a bonding bill anytime soon? Because this is not the first time we've heard this specific question from individuals facing these issues. Of course, there's other issues around the state too. I mean, I may have some local projects myself. But do you anticipate anytime soon? I know there was talk about there being a bonding bill in the beginning of the year.
So Representative Franson, good question. I think that as many of the committee members and members of the public know that a bonding bill requires a supermajority in the House and the Senate to pass, and so it is my hope that I could work with the minority caucuses here and also the Senate majority minority caucus to move something forward. It depends on whether the individual caucuses want to work with me to get a bonding bill passed soon. Members, any additional questions? Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Director Johnson.
Thank you, Chair.
Next on the agenda, we have Department of Employment and Economic Development Deputy Commissioner Kevin McKinnon. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. Kevin McKinnon. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of Economic Development at DEED, and happy to be here today to talk about DEED's capital budget request. The programs that are listed here, these assist communities, local units of government, with the costs of public infrastructure for business development. Cities, counties, businesses, et cetera, are sources to facilitate development projects, and this is a way that we help lower development costs for our communities as a way to help them expand their tax base. So we have four asks in the capital budget this year, $8.4 million for our Business Development Public Infrastructure Grant Program. These all have acronyms, so this is BDPI. $4.8 for our Transportation Economic Development Infrastructure Program, and $1.2 for our Innovative Business Development Public Infrastructure Program, or IBDPI, and $572,000 for administration of these grants. The first program that I want to describe is our Business Development Public Infrastructure Program. This is a program which is only available in Greater Minnesota or outside of our of the seven county metro area. It's used to facilitate investment generally of industrial uses or warehouse type uses. It does require a 50% match at the local level and can be used to fund wastewater collection and treatment, sanitary sewer, storm sewers, utility extension, roads, etc., to help facilitate the development. We usually see these projects with an end business or a business that's trying to expand. This program does allow some speculative development. We have a cap of $2 million per community, which must be matched at 50%. We're generally much less than 50% as these development costs are and can be expensive. We accept applications on a rolling basis, so as projects are developed at the local level, they come to us and apply for them. There are prohibitions on retail and office use on the sites that are developed with this infrastructure. However, there is a provision that was passed by the legislature a couple of years ago that if nothing happens on that property after 10 years, alternative uses can be accommodated on that property. So just as an example, we gave provided $176,000 to the city of Owatonna in the last year for construction of a new street and utilities to support a new investment in Owatonna from Bosch. 260,000 square foot warehouse that created 50 jobs. We've operated this program for 15, 18 years, very successful in Greater Minnesota, and I'm sure most of you have heard from our folks out there about the importance of this to the local units of government. Our next, the next program that I would talk about is our Transportation Economic Development Infrastructure Program, or as we refer to it as TEDI. This is a statewide program that DEED offers funding to help with non-trunk highway expenses, and that may be used in combination with trunk highway investments. This program is run jointly with MnDOT, and so we evaluate applications together, we make recommendations together, and of course both commissioners sign off on the projects that are to be funded. But things such as pre-design, land acquisition, construction costs, reconstruction, infrastructure improvements, etc., are allowable costs to help facilitate interchange development or additional roadways to alleviate traffic. We generally do one RFP a year, depending on how often this is funded and when it's funded, and usually in combination with MnDOT. And so one of our recent projects was up in Sherburne County. We awarded $950,000 to assist with the expansion of the Becker Business Park to provide better access to that park for some of the heavier traffic that's going to be in and out of there. 50 jobs and hundreds of millions of capital investment are expected as a result of that. Our third program is our Innovative Business Development Public Infrastructure Program, or IBDPI. This, too, is a statewide program. It is much like the Business Development Public Infrastructure Program, except that it is focused on innovative uses on that property. And innovative use is defined in the laws. It's really around proprietary technology, proprietary processes or services that are delivered. So if you think of research and development type projects, that's generally what you're seeing. Much the same from eligible costs, wastewater systems, drinking systems, roads, bridges, etc., are funded out of there. It does require a 50% match, and we also accept applications on a rolling basis for this program. An example, we provided $475,000 to the City of Woodbury for turn lanes and intersection improvements associated with a new development just off of 94 for Condeva drug delivery. This project invested $35 million and created 35 new jobs into their new building, and ultimately facilitated additional development opportunities for that area. The last piece here that we are requesting is $572,000 for administration of the local grants. Just within the projects that I talked about, we would estimate there'd probably be somewhere between 30 and 35 project awards, just in the capital programs that we run. We are not allowed to take administration from general obligation bond funding, and so as this is funded up and down over the past few years, in addition to special appropriations that we receive, including in 2020 over 50 projects, we are trying to create a unit that is focused on bonding projects, and certainly to be more responsive to our customers and the projects that we see through this type of funding. Our office manages hundreds of these, as you are aware, and as most of you know, these projects can last 5 years. And so there's constant communication and constant work that's going on as these projects are considered. So. With that, Mr. Chair and members, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Representative Scrabble.
Thank you, Chairman Lee. Question,
you're not allowed to take dollars from the funding that we're giving to the other groups? Is it coming from the same pile, or are you asking for general fund or general obligation? Could you clarify for me, please? Thank you, Chairman.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the agencies are not allowed to take administrative funding directly from the appropriation that we receive in general obligation bonds. This 572 would be in a cash portion of any bonding bill. Yep.
Thank you. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, just for my understanding, what was innovative in particular about the project in Woodbury, turn lanes and...
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Ryer, it's the use that's innovative. And by that, I mean the business user who is benefiting from the public infrastructure that's developed. And Kindeva is a drug delivery company that puts patches on skin, I believe, and injects drugs into the system.
So, Commissioner, I think I asked this question last year when D was before us. The IAB DPI program is a statewide program, but we only have a request of 1.2. Can you tell us why such a low number? And then of the last time that you ran an RFP on this program, what was the actual number of requests?
Mr. Chair and members, obviously, in putting together a bonding bill, there are targets, and this fell where it did within the targets of the bonding bill. The last funding round we did, I believe we received somewhere in the neighborhood of 1.6 or 1.8 million. I think we did five different projects with that. In fact, four projects, and we've got one that is actually in. We have a balance in that account of about 400,000, which that project will take. So we are effectively out of money in that program. We have not seen maybe the uptick, and particularly given the amount of business development public infrastructure we have from a greater Minnesota perspective, because essentially it kind of does a little bit of the same thing. But in the metro area as well, there's many instances where there's infrastructure already in sites. And so that's a little bit of what we've been dealing with here in the metro, and you're dealing with larger cities with a little bit more capacity to be investing in that infrastructure.
And then can you remind the committee if the program have any cap on the amount of a grant amount, or is that open-ended for the agency to decide?
Mr. Chair and members, the BDPI program has a cap of $2 million per city every 2 years, I believe. The Innovative Business Development Public Infrastructure Program does not have a cap listed. However, I believe the largest one we've ever done is maybe $1.5 million in that range, and that's just based on how much money we've had. There were some projects years ago that we did with IBDPI, which is why there was no cap. And then the TEDI program does not have a cap either.
Seeing no other questions, thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Last on the agenda, we have the Department of Corrections. Welcome, Commissioner. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Paul Schnell, and I'm the Commissioner of Minnesota Department of Corrections. Thank you for having me here today. The opportunity to provide an overview of the governor's bonding recommendations for the Department of Corrections. Members, in understanding the DOC's asset preservation and capital investment project needs, it's first important to understand the department's mission, which is to transform lives for a safer Minnesota. The DOC not only provides secure housing to the incarcerated people in the facilities, it is in these facilities that we provide health care, treatment, and programming needs, along with transitional services as the incarcerated individuals prepare for community reentry. To accomplish our mission, we must successfully provide these services because 95% of the people in our prisons will one day return to communities across our state. Research shows that successful interventions during incarceration, along with solid reentry planning and engaged community supervision, greatly reduces the likelihood of reoffending. In addition, the DOC facilities are 24/7 work environments for some 4,000 dedicated staff who serve the state each day, often under the most challenging of circumstances. Accomplishing our mission and supporting our staff is made difficult when we have leaking roofs, pipes crumbling, and we have space for only a fraction of the services we need to deliver. For your reference, on the slide we're showing, you can see the 11 prison facilities that DOC operates across the state, and I would strongly encourage you to take a tour of these facilities and speak directly to the dedicated staff and the individuals incarcerated in them. The physical spaces and services and population of these prisons vary significantly. A couple of examples of note. The facility in Shakopee is Minnesota's only women's prison. The Red Wing facility is a juvenile correctional facility focused heavily on treatment. The St. Cloud facility serves as the central intake facility for men. Faribault is the state's largest facility with a population capacity of just over 2,000. The Togo facility up near Canada is the smallest facility and a highly successful boot camp, one of the state's two boot camps for men. And finally, the prison in Stillwater and St. Cloud, you should know, are both well over 100 years old. The numbers on this slide provide a high-level overview of the department. Our work with you on this committee is critical because the Department of Corrections is 96% funded by the state's general fund. The DOC has extremely limited in options to preserve our facilities, improve them, without relying almost entirely on bonding funding. The DOC has an enormous footprint across the state with 11 prisons, 7.5 million square feet of facility space, making a bonding request just to address deferred maintenance critical. To say that there's a lot of upkeep needed is an understatement, particularly when you consider the age of our buildings and the high degree of use. The overall total of the DOC's bonding request is $111.8 million. The content of this request is the same as what we proposed last year, with the inclusion of inflationary costs and recognizing that our asset preservation needs grow as conditions further deteriorate. Asset preservation is the largest and most critical need within the DOC and reflects $76 million of the governor's budget. The other three requests are all related to the expansion of needed programming space and facilities for treatment, education, and services, which I'll speak to momentarily. Again, first and foremost, asset preservation is the DOC's highest priority within the bonding bill. With the deteriorating condition of so many of our buildings, the $76 million is badly needed. I should note that the DOC has over $650 million in deferred maintenance. The governor's recommendation puts most of this funding forward in a cash request. While the vast majority of the DOC's asset preservation needs can be funded with GO bonds, there is a need for including some cash to ensure the projects are fully completed. Preserving and updating infrastructure in our state prisons requires a significant amount of technology unique to this agency's security requirements, components that are oftentimes not bondable. The security needs of our buildings are integral to their design and upkeep. However, the lifespan of these components is often not long enough for GO bonds to be used to cover them. There are many reasons why asset preservation is the DOC's number one priority. We need this funding to address our reliance on the state's general fund for our regular operations and the capital budget, capital investment process. The advanced age and complexities of our facilities. State prisons are heavily used buildings where they are both working and living environments used 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And the protection of the health and safety of those who work and reside in them is a critical and constitutional priority in some instances. Members, the remaining three priorities of the department are all intended to expand programming and treatment. In learning about the DOC's significant need for treatment and programming space, it's important to understand that the DOC has shifted its focus to a more person-centered focus. Simply put, the person-centered approach, it organizes and matches evidence-based programs and services targeted against the needs and risk factors of the people who are in the system. However, in order to ensure successful programming and treatment occur, we must have the space for it. And right now, we are significantly lacking in that physical space. Members, as you can see, Minnesota's prison population is staggeringly disproportionate, an issue that we must address and are devoting considerable attention to. I also want to draw your attention to the numbers on the right side of this slide. Each of these data points reflects a unique and important challenge in addressing the risks and needs of those in our system. The next project I want to highlight is the restoration and expansion of the Dakota building at the facility in Faribault. A few members of this committee have toured that building in November of 21. Faribault, as I mentioned, is the largest facility in the DOC, and the Dakota building is a minimum security unit outside the secure perimeter. The men who live in this building are at the end of their prison time. The services they receive in the Dakota building are critical to get right, because this is the time just prior to their reentry into the community. With this new space plan for this project, we will support these men and their access to programming such as adult basic education and vocational training, treatment services, and pre-release planning services. Next is the expansion of programming space at the state's only women's facility in Shakopee. The availability of space has not increased enough as the population has grown over time. When this prison was built, it was accommodated 350 women. Today, the population of women at the facility ranges from 500 to 600 women at any given time. We have community partners and staff who will provide transformative programming, such as parenting skills, education, and treatment, and more, but not enough space to provide these services. And finally, the DOC is requesting investment to rehabilitate a currently vacant building at the Lionel Lakes facility. This is a viable building for treatment use, but has been vacant for many years and must be rehabilitated. For reference, the Department of Corrections is the single largest substance use disorder treatment provider in the state of Minnesota. Ensuring that we have the space for robust, meaningful treatment is key in our ability to successfully rehabilitate those in our the state incarcerates who have substance use disorders and mental illnesses. Mr. Chair, members, I distinctly remember the words early when I started in this role from a former member of this committee who explained that legislative policy, bonding, and mission of work of our agency are and should be inextricably linked. And to that end, correctional services have a direct impact on the public safety of our state, including crime reduction, fewer victims, and safer communities. A 1 percentage point reduction in the state's 3-year re-imprisonment rate would yield an estimated $5.4 million in costs avoided, and an estimated $57.7 million in costs avoided to the larger state, business and industry, and society in general. This work is important and critical to our state. It is hard to understand what's being done in our prisons on any given day, and I would certainly invite and encourage you to come and visit them and see it firsthand. With that, Mr. Chair and members, I will stand for any questions the committee may have.
Thank you, Commissioner Snow. Members, any questions for the commissioner? Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. So you have 82 structures in crisis or poor condition?
That's correct. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if we wait another year or two, that wouldn't make much difference, would it?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, what's going to end up happening is we're going to be pushing back project after project after project, and the criticality of the need is only going to become worse. So it would be super damaging if we did not make these investments and begin to fix these buildings.
Representative Erdahl.
All right, thank you.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just looking over the presentation and hearing what you're talking or saying, I just want to say thank you. It looks like you're focusing heavily on the staff safety and, you know, that's really important, and the individuals that are in there. We've, you know, had some recent issues, I know in East Metro and beyond, but I'm really glad you're focusing on the safety of staff, so thank you.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lovely, thank you for that. This is something that is really significant and serious. We know that, you know, as I mentioned, some of these facilities are over 100 years old. They were not designed in a modern way to be able to deliver services and provide for much safer environments for both staff and the people who are incarcerated. It's one of the challenges we face with the old infrastructure that we have.
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair Lee, and to Commissioner. Thank you for this presentation. I have questions that I look forward to continue offline, but the one question that I have around the rehab and preservation and shelter spaces, I'm wondering, as you're looking to invest and preserve the spaces that exist, how is it that your department takes into care for men's and women's shelter, but there are trans and gender expansive folks in the state, of which I am one? Can you talk about the gender inclusive policies for ways that we can make sure to prevent and affirm folks who don't identify as men or women, as well as on the accessibility front as we're looking at making these investments to make sure that for gender as well as folks who have accessibility challenges, we're taking care of them as well?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for that question. This has been an area of considerable focus for our agency, and I would welcome the chance to talk with you offline. We know this has been, you know, particularly meeting the needs of transgendered folks who are in the criminal justice system is one of the major areas of focus among my colleagues and conversations I'm having with my colleagues around the country. Minnesota recently adopted some additional updates to our policies to make sure that we're addressing the needs of people regardless. And this, you know, being able to access our facilities and making sure that they're accessible is a huge priority. And, you know, we know that in order to be responsive and reflect the needs of people, we have both policies on the side of our healthcare and mental health services and so forth to meet folks' needs. But we also need to make sure our space is conducive to the safety and security of people, regardless of their sexual identity. And we want to make sure that that's what we provide.
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you so much, Commissioner. And maybe a first of its kind question, but it's really important, so thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Scrabble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I come from a lot of projects in my community, and when I looked at the 7 points for your priority for 7.7 million, 8,400 square feet, it works out to $916 a square foot. I know new construction somewhere around $450 in New York City, and in my community, it's more like $250, $300. Are prisons and government administration that much more? I'm curious, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Schnell.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you. That's a great question. One of the things about the unique about correctional settings is all of the electronic components, the ability to manage door openings, holding spaces that are built into these facilities. And so there is a considerable amount of investment in the security infrastructure, cameras, all of those requirements do make them far more expensive than just traditional build-outs of space inside that shell.
Representative Scrabble.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. Commissioner, thank you for, and I want to applaud my colleague, Representative Kozlowski, for her question about transgender folks. Back when I was in law school, I served in the prisoner assistance clinic. It was my first exposure to a correctional setting. And it made a big impression on me. But also what made an impression on me was a client that we retained. It was a transitioning transsexual. And the question was is that this person was born a male transitioning to a female. And this person was in a maximum security prison in Iowa. And the question was, how do you treat that person? We found out in our research that there are national symposiums and conferences about the transsexual in prison. And this was back in the late 80s. So I imagine it's only become more, I don't know if prevalent, but more consciousness to it. And so the question is, what programming and facilities do you have to accommodate transsexual folks? Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think you're right that there has been a lot more awareness, a lot more knowledge. There's a lot more expertise that we're able to access to really help inform the system. The range of services are both mental health. There is the full range of medical services for people, whether that's hormone treatments and so forth, that do get provided for transgender folks inside of our facilities, and up to including options for placement in the facility, different than their birth or their physical identity that they were born with. So we are looking. We provide the full range of services, but we need to make sure that we have safe and secure environments for people, and that has been a challenge both in the Minnesota Department of Corrections and in correctional settings across the nation. I don't want to be Pollyannish about this. This is an area of considerable learning, an area that we've invested a considerable amount of time and energy in from a policy standpoint, from a training standpoint for our staff, and we continue to have work to do, but I think we've made great progress.
Representative Carroll. Thank you for that response. Let me just be a little more specific. So the question in our case was that a men's maximum security prison was no place for a person who identified as a woman to be. Why shouldn't she be in the women's prison, which was in a different city? So the question was, which went to the Eighth Circuit, how are you going to accommodate for that? The prison didn't want to accommodate. They didn't want to make special arrangements. One, have you come across that issue? And two, how have you dealt with it? In terms
Commissioner, response, and then after that, you two could take the, if there's more questions, offline. Yeah. Yeah. Commissioner.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we do have policies that address that specific issue where we can transfer a transgendered individual to a facility of their that they're transitioning to, or their that reflects their identity.
Thank you. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe these questions would be better off in the Public Safety Committee. Otherwise, I'm going to start asking a lot of questions, and once I start asking a lot of questions, we're never going to get off the topic. So,
thank you for that, Representative Franzen. Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair Lee and Commissioner, and respectfully, I think these conversations belong in every single committee that we're at, and I hope that this is the first of many conversations. It is clearly an area that is going to continue to be something that we've got to figure out. We have a lot of youth, people in this space now, and I also wanted to say that the language that we use is matters as we're having a lot of learning. The use of transsexual is, you actually said it, Commissioner, transgender and non-binary and gender expansive. Transsexual is a word that's very hurtful to the community, and recognize that in the spirit of learning, but wanted to just add that, and with that I will yield back and do look forward to having an offline conversation as well as on the record conversations. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kozlowski.
Seeing no other questions, thank you, Commissioner Schnell, for coming by the committee today. Members, thank you to all the commissioners that came by and presented the staff. Our next meeting is on Monday, February 6th, where we'll be hearing from the MAC Council, Bowser, Amateur Sports Commissions, the State Academies, Kirby Center for Arts Education, and the Department of Agriculture. With that, this is adjourned.